Hey, everybody. All right, well, we finished up Proverbs last week. And so what are we going to do? It's a big question. You know, I'm actually honestly going to do my best to avoid that book. How many years do I have to live? I think I can keep putting that off. We've been reading through a lot of the books of the Old Testament. I don't know, you know, how long you've been here, through how many of them that you've been here through. But if we were to imagine the Old Testament like an old house, and imagine ourselves, in fact, just employ your God-given gift for imagination and see us walking down a long hallway in this old house. And lining the hallway on either side are all these doors that lead away from the hall. And we've been exploring a lot of these doors. We first went up to a door, and it was marked Genesis, and we opened it up, and when we opened it up, we realized that it went out into this huge vista that watched the birth of a planet and the birth of a nation and the stories and the people involved in that. And when we got finished with that room, we walked into another room and opened it up. It was labeled Exodus. And when we opened it up, it opened out on this vast desert, and we were looking at fire in the sky and a cloud of smoke that was covering over a ragtag caravan of refugees that were finding their way by God's power and purpose to a life of freedom. And we went through a lot of different doors, all these different doors that opened up on kings and battles and the stories of the people involved. And we opened up one door, and it was full of musicians, and they were all in there jamming and singing songs about God and about his amazing ways. And it's been an enlightening and an interesting journey through this old house. But now as we're going along down this hallway, we notice another, like, sub-hallway leading off of the main hallway. And down at the end of that hallway is another door. And as we start down this little sub-hallway, we suddenly feel ourselves slightly uncomfortable, and our equilibrium is strangely askew because all the angles in this hallway are off. And when we get down near the door, we notice it's smaller than the other doors, and it's actually pretty pretty ratty itself, and it's hanging strangely on its hinges, and nothing is really square on the whole thing. And as we're up against this door, we notice that somebody's actually been here before us, and they even pinned a note to the door, and it says, there's nothing to see here. Don't enter. There's no need. And it's signed, actually, by none other than Cyrus Ingerson Schofield, the great American theologian. How interesting, huh? That actually, more than anything, makes me want to go through that door. I want to know what the deal is, what's going on behind this door. So we open it up, and instead of seeing some sweeping vista of maybe a battlefield where a war is raging for God's honor or something like that, we actually open up on a very small room. It's a little study, and it's a dimly lit room, and there's bookshelves lining the walls, and there's a globe, and there are stuffed animals all around. And behind a desk at the far end of the room sits a very old, old man. And he's wearing a scholar's mortar board and a black robe over his shoulders. You know what the mortar board is. And he's got a black robe over his shoulders. But there's something really, really strange about this guy, because he's also wearing flip-flops and a t-shirt that says "Party Till You Puke" on it. And we're glancing around the study, and all of a sudden we realize that on this bookshelf there's not a lot of theology books at all, but there's books on natural history, and there's books on philosophy, and there's books on natural sciences. So we actually have to look back over our shoulder and wonder, wait a minute, did we take a wrong turn back here somewhere? Are we still in the same house? And we even asked the guy, are we still in the Bible, or did we take a wrong turn somewhere? Are we somewhere else? But the old man has actually lit a pipe. And as he takes a deep draw on it and exhales a plume of smoke, we watch that smoke as it wafts over his desk lamp and dissipates in front of him. And he's sitting there with a smile on his face as he watches that smoke fade away. And he answers us, smoke. Nothing but smoke. There's nothing to anything. It's all smoke. What do you think? Are you in? Does that sound intriguing to you? Are you interested in what's going on with it? I mean, who is this guy? Is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? His attire is kind of strange. Is he telling us about God or is he telling us about humanity or is it a little bit of both? Is he pointing us onto the right path or is he warning us about the wrong path or is he like the Scarecrow in the Wizard of Oz? Is he pointing both ways and letting us decide? I'm fascinated by him. Something troubles me about him, and yet at the same time, I recognize something very deep is happening in this little room we've walked into here. Something resonates with me, with this old man, in ways that I can't fully articulate. There's something here in this study, and I'm drawn to it. So what do you guys think? Are we in? Are we in? Are we going to go in here, and we're going to hang out here for a little bit? All right, the label on the door says Ecclesiastes, and if you've got a Bible of some kind, you want to go to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. It's a door right next to where we just were in the book of Proverbs. Everything was neat and orderly in that book. Now we've come through this door, and things are a little bit different. And we noticed as we were looking at the sign on the door that said Ecclesiastes, somebody had come by with a penknife and scratched in the word honesty underneath it. And that's probably a good subtitle for this room. The word Ecclesiastes comes from the Latin transliteration of the Greek transliteration of the Hebrew word Koheleth. And it means someone who leads an assembly. So it gets translated either as preacher or teacher or speaker, depending on what translation you're using. I would say, apart from questions about the style of the book, most scholars, both Christian and Jewish alike, lean towards Solomon as being the author of this book. And there's a lot of, I don't really want to bog down with all of that, we've done that before, but I think there's a lot of good evidence that indicates that Solomon was more than likely the author here. I'm comfortable with that. We don't know for sure, so we'll leave that slightly open-ended. We would consider, if this is Solomon, we would consider this a work that he did near the end of his life, having been king for some time, because he describes himself as that later on in the book. Now, it's interesting that both in Jewish history and in Christian history, people have struggled to know what to do with this book all along. This book has been pretty much an enigma for everybody. At times, it corroborates the wisdom offered in Proverbs and in other scriptures, but then it turns a corner and absolutely contradicts things that it was in, and sometimes it'll contradict itself as it's going along. The most prevalent way of reading this is to say that it is a book describing the best that man can achieve outside of God, outside of a worldview that has accepted God. Therefore, most commonly you hear people basically say, even as Schofield had said, this entire work is dedicated to what not to think or what not to do. And I'm not exactly sure I buy that. I'm not exactly sure I'm in agreement with that idea. I think what we have here in the midst of all of this sacred writing, planted here in this strange little sub-hallway, is a very honest, very non-religious look at the difficulties and perplexities of life in a fallen world, on this broken planet. This book doesn't seem to worry at all that it's going to offend people who think that they've got life and God all figured out and neatly categorized. This book doesn't settle for neat, pat answers to deeply complex issues. I think that this book invites us to confront the very sad and oftentimes skeptical thoughts that we usually don't permit ourselves to think because we fear it's going to be a lack of faith if we do it. Someone once said that Ecclesiastes is the only book of the Bible written on a Monday morning. And that is by and large because of the fairly gloomy perspective that seems to come across on most of these pages. And we're going to find more, though, than just cynicism in this book. We're going to consider the consequences of living for purely a temporal happiness instead of living a life the way God intended it. We'll contemplate those things as we go along. We're going to confront questions that hang in the air at all times, even to this day. Not so much questions about God's existence. That's sort of taken for granted in this book. It assumes that. But more perplexing a question is, does God matter? What difference does God make in this world that we live in? We need to think of this teacher here, the old man, as a realist. He's a person who has made God his base camp, but he's out exploring. He's out looking around. He's exploring because he's not satisfied with Sunday school answers to difficult questions that get posed because of the strangeness of life as it is. I love this guy because this guy gives me permission to think freely. And that's one of the things that we need to realize about the Scriptures. That's one of those things that it oftentimes gets shoved aside, and we get used to pat answers that are given to us as a certain regulation on how it is we're supposed to confront these issues. But here we're given permission to think freely and wrestle with these difficult questions. So I'll tell you, as we get into this book, you got to bring your wrestling shoes with you, because we're going to grapple with some stuff as we go. Yet even with all of this, even with his exploration, even with his what seems at some ways, at some turns, shocking behavior that he indulges himself in, there is still this quiet, steady confidence that comes through that seems to at least assure me that the answers that I'm looking for are not necessarily going to be found, nor are those answers the most important thing. The book itself, being such an enigma, nobody knowing exactly what to do with this thing, sort of drives the point home to me. The fact that it's even sitting here like this, the fact that it sits here and gets avoided for the most part because nobody knows what to do with this thing. Everybody's a little bit uncomfortable with it. I think that in itself tells us something about the nature of this book. We want to categorize this book because that's what we do. We want to take this book and we want to put it neatly in its right column, but this book keeps jumping out and it's too wild for that. It won't stay in a nice, neat column for us. We look at this. Is he telling us about the wrong way of thinking, or is he telling us the right way to think? And the answer to it is yes. And we walk away kind of puzzled. Life is complex. That's one of the things that's going to come through in this so clearly, whereas the book of Proverbs was dealing with larger issues, larger life truths that are true, that we can look at and recognize are the ways in which things work in this world and how God is operating. Yet, even with those larger answers, you're not going to find a blanket answer to everything. And there are complexities that we deal with in the details that this book takes to heart. There's no super spiritual plane that we're going to get to that everyone is staying at all times. There's life here, and there's trouble in the details. And sometimes life is good, and sometimes life is bad. And even with the bigger picture that God provides in the rest of the Scriptures, there's this nagging struggle with a sense of futility as we deal with it all. And that's okay. The old man behind the desk says, he smiles slightly, it's okay that you feel that way, that you wrestle with those things. God knows what's happening with us. And God is not afraid of questions. In fact, God's pretty big, and he can handle any kind of questions that we throw at him. He knows that life is full of both faith and failure. And there's a lot of experiences in between those. The Message paraphrases what the teacher says in chapter 7, verse 18 in Ecclesiastes, as it words it this way: it's best to stay in touch with both sides of an issue. A person who fears God deals responsibly with all of reality, not just a piece of it. So with that, we're going to begin this look at this book, this strange book, this honest look at life on a fallen planet in a broken world. And we start here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. So if you're there, we'll begin with the first couple of verses. It says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem." This is where we initially make the assumption that this is Solomon, though this could have been referring to any king. But the one that is talking here, his character and his experiences best describe Solomon as best as we can understand it. Verse 2. "Vanities of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities all is vanity. So here he is. He's king of Jerusalem. And like I said, we can't be sure, but we believe it's Solomon. And Solomon, you know, is what the scriptures describe as the wisest man who lived on the planet. The smartest dude around. I mean, he had it going on. He asked God for wisdom. God said, sure, I'll give you wisdom. And so what is the wisdom that Solomon's going to bring to us, that he's going to share with us? Everything's vanity. Everything's pointless. Wow, cheery guy you are, Solomon. Thanks. As with the book itself, being an enigma as it is, this word vanity actually has been very difficult to interpret. It's been a little bit slippery as scholars have looked at it, but since it appears so often in this work, comes up dozens of times, we really need to take a look at what we think it means when he's saying this word vanity. It's believed that it's a multi-purpose metaphor that he's employing here. It's literally the word in the Hebrew is havel, and it means vapor or breath, or you could say a puff of smoke. The same kind of idea. The idea, like when you're outside and when, either the winter here on that short winter we get, or if you lived up north, when you'd get outside in the really cold and you'd breathe and your air, you'd see your breath go out, but it never stays. It always dissipates. It always goes away. And that's the concept of this. We take this word to be an expression of the temporary nature of life, but also the frailty of life and the sense of futility that can be associated with it. It's intangible. Like trying to nail smoke to a wall is the same thing as trying to find some sense of meaning in some of the difficulties that we go through as the human race so often in this life. Now, this is the thematic heading of the work, to begin this way. When he starts off, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. That's the theme, and it's a place that we're going to return to right up to the ending resolution of the book. We're going to return to this over and over again. We're going to bring it all to its conclusion at the end, but he's going to have something else to say. But this is an honest and brutal assessment of what life can be like. I mean, that any person, any thinking, observant person would listen to those words, would read those words, and have to, on some level, say, yeah, I know why he's saying that. I know why he's expressing something like that. I certainly have seen this. I've certainly felt this in life as even I've experienced. So he goes on then. He's beginning by this statement, this utter sense of meaninglessness to this fallen world. We get to verse 3. What does man gain by all of the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. It's unchanged. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and then it goes around to the north, and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run into the sea, but the sea isn't full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It's been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Okay, we'll stop right there. So he begins with this question. What kind of a return can we expect out of all that we invest in this life? What kind of what gain is it? The term in the Hebrew is actually a marketing terminology. What kind of return is this going to, what profit is this going to give me when I experience all this stuff on this planet? When I do all the things that I do here, what's behind it? What's it going to get me? And when he says here, all the things that we do under the sun, we have to understand that's actually a key phrase in this thing. He's talking about life here on this planet under the natural light, under the sun. And in that sense, we could say that this is from that perspective that's limited in its scope. It's the perspective that we have with the natural light that we're given here, life on this fallen planet. And when we consider the the natural, the fallen world, he's saying, what's our return for all of the investment of the time and the energy that we put into this place and all the various things that we do? What's it add up to? What's it going to mean? And the answer is nothing. Not a thing is what he says. It's just going round in circles. That's the whole concept that he gets there. The teacher points to all of the repetitions that we see in the natural world, the circular, redundant nature of things that we observe on the planet, which just goes on and on and on and never seems to produce anything new. It just keeps going round and round and round, having no real start and no real end. It just continues on that cycle. And then it appears in that sense to be without direction, without any sort of purpose, that sense of circular reasoning. But it's not just winds and rivers and sunsets and sunrises that he's talking about. He's also talking about people as well when he says this. Like the tide, people cover this earth and then they vanish. We spread out as a generation and then we sink and fade away as that same generation. And we think about just the scores of human beings that once occupied the space that we take up here now that we know nothing about. We had never knew they existed. We never, ever will know anything about them, what they did, what they thought, who they loved, what they hoped for or dreamed about. It all left the planet with them, and it all disappeared when they were gone. And this endless march of human generations from birth to grave, all appearing to be part of this cycle, seems so purposeless. That's what he's saying. This repetitive cycle of the natural world isn't going anywhere, doesn't achieve anything, doesn't amount to anything. Now, just as an aside, this is really strange that he's talking like this, that he's saying these kinds of things, because this is actually quite modern and quite foreign to the Hebrew way of thinking. The Hebrew thinking is quite linear. Everything had its beginning in a Genesis. Everything has its conclusion at the end of things. Everything's always linear. You even think in terms of Christian thought. It's linear. But here, he's expressing that something that's actually quite pagan, it was exemplified in Greek thought, this circular notion of this endless cycle of life, of continuing on and on, and the circularity to the whole thing. Here's this king of Jerusalem. I imagine he's probably blowing smoke rings and tracing the lines around his globe, thinking about all of these things in circularity. I find that fascinating. The point is, people like to talk about progress. In fact, we hear about that all the time. Anytime a politician opens his mouth or her mouth, you're going to hear about progress and all the great achievements. Human achievements are lauded, and evolutionary advancements are talked about all the time. We're always keen on bringing those things up, but the teacher here says that it's all a myth. There's no new thing under the sun. What we experience now is just a variation of what's been experienced before. It just continues going on and on. It's in circles. It's the same old, is what he's saying. There's nothing really new in this. There's nothing advancing in this. This is the way this is. But that doesn't stop us from constantly questing. And that's what's so interesting. We recognize this. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of years, millions upon millions, maybe billions of people that have lived and died and gone through this. And all the things that we continue, though, it's built into us. It resonates with us, this continual quest. We want to hear, we want to see, we're craving something, we're looking for something that never seems to get satisfied. The eye and the ear never get their fill, he says. And that was true then, that's true today for sure. In fact, how curious is it that that's a hallmark of the world that we live in? We have this constant, steady stream of audio-visual stimulation coming to us on a regular basis from the time we get up to the time we go to bed at night. And if we got a TV in the bedroom, it's on into the past our sleeping hours. We've got this constant stream from Netflix to YouTube to our iPad and our iPod and our smartphone, and we're never away from some sort of auditory or visual input stimulation that comes into it. And yet I notice that it's not like anybody says, hey, you have Netflix? Well, yeah, I saw a movie once. I don't need that anymore. No, nobody thinks like that. You gotta load that queue up, baby. We gotta all kinds of movies that we gotta be able to see. We gotta keep them coming. I never get tired of that. We never get enough. We're gonna keep on texting and Facebooking and tweeting and listening and watching. We're gonna keep doing that. And yet Solomon says, the teacher says, yeah, we do that. It never gets full. And then he poses that question, but yet, what do we gain? We never seem to be filled. It's insatiable. We're so hungry for something to see, something to hear. And yet when we see, when we hear, it never gets filled up. And what do we gain from the whole thing? Maybe that's a good question to ask ourselves after an hour on Facebook. The teacher finishes this section of repetitions with a line about memory loss. We don't remember what happened before. And the people after us are not going to remember what we did, what we were up to. We're a planet of amnesiacs. We live here in this present moment that we're afforded on this space. We forget so much. We forget most of what we ourselves have experienced in this lifetime. And even when advances do get made, it's not long before things begin to revert back to its normal state because we forget. In fact, the planet itself seems to conspire against any sort of real lasting advance. You build something and you leave it alone for a while, and what's going to happen? The planet's going to come and take it over and suck it back inside, and it gets forgotten over all that time. If life is lived simply under the sun, if everything that we're looking for, wanting out of life, is only going to be found on this plane in the things that we can see illuminated by natural light, then there is nothing to it. Because when you look at what's gone before us and what we're in presently and what will come, there's nothing to it then. If all there is to life is what we can see under the natural light. Jesus even states this in Mark 8, what will it profit if a man gains the whole world but loses his soul? There's got to be something outside of that. If this life is all there is, then yes, life is futile, absolutely futile. That's why the revelation of Christ is so important. It draws us up from life under the sun to life in the sun from that new perspective, that perspective of God and what it is that he plans and where this thing is going. But the teacher doesn't say that. The teacher actually doesn't feel the need to even press that side of the question. He's just illuminating something here. He's just pointing something out. For everybody who's running around on that little squirrel cage, zipping around, trying to achieve something, make something happen, it's happened. It went around once, it'll do it again, and it'll keep doing it, but that's it. We get to verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that's done under heaven. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. All right, verse 13 here, the teacher is stating his purpose in this book. He has become a seeker. He is on a quest to find some sort of meaning out of all of this stuff in life. And it's a sincere thing that he's doing. This is not some bored college kid taking bong hits and wondering, you know, what to do next. This is, by saying that he's applied his heart to this task, it means that he's got a sincere desire to know this, to understand life better. And it's coming from the very core of who he is, from the core of his being. And that's a good quest. It's not an easy one. The easy thing to do is to settle for all the pat answers or to think about nothing at all, just practice escapism. But he wants to roll up his sleeve and he wants to dig for answers. And that's a good thing. We never want to be afraid of asking questions. We never want to be afraid of asking questions. And when we even build our doctrinal positions, which have been built up for a long time, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with coming to those conclusions and learning and trying to find a plateau of understanding. We still never want to be afraid of questions or asking questions or people who do ask questions. Asking questions, seeking answers, that's a positive, godly thing. But we're going to learn from the teacher's pursuits the answers that we look for are not always easy to come by. They're not always that ready to be found. And the main reason for his quest is this inexplicable lot of mankind, the mystery behind all the difficulties of life. Why is it that God has ordained, or we could at least say, why is it that he's allowed that mankind should have to suffer and endure all of these painful experiences that we do, that humanity as a whole, as a group, have to experience on this fallen planet? He describes life as an unhappy business. Ever feel that way about life? Ever look at life and think, well, this is an unhappy business. This is a raw deal. Now, listen, I know that Paul says in Romans 8:20, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain a freedom of the glory of the children of God. So, you know, the answer that we normally give when we look at the futility, we look at the pain, we look at the suffering, the unhappy business of life, the answer we normally give to this is that was not God's original design. This is not what he had in mind. This isn't what he intended on doing, but he's allowed this futility to reign in order to draw people into the light because of the hope that's offered by God. And that works. That answer works on a theological level, but if you're sitting there looking at a child, some three-year-old child with cancer who's only known sickness his whole life, both from the disease and from the cure, from chemo, that's bad business. That's a nice theological answer, but boy, it's hard to face some of the things that go on this planet. And if it doesn't hurt, if it doesn't confuse us, something's wrong in that whole scene. If it doesn't affect us on a level where we're walking away perplexed and constrained by the troubles and the real difficulties of this world, then we're not living in reality on this planet anymore. We've made ourselves a nice little religious box. We've painted it all over with the pat answers and we hide in there. And we're not really confronting or dealing with the reality of what's going on here. We've isolated ourselves in a room of easy answers. The teacher examines everything under the sun. He's seeking all the wisdom he can get by observation and by examination. But he comes to the conclusion that it'd be easier to catch the wind. It'd be easier to catch the wind and put a string on it than it would be to try to answer some of these hard questions. When he says, what is crooked won't be made straight, he's not saying what's corrupt or morally wrong, but the Hebrew meaning is more like inscrutable. It's something that's unknowable. You can't figure this thing out. We can't examine this thing and come up with a logical conclusion by analyzing it properly. He says, you know, what's lost can't be counted. What we don't have. In other words, you know, you can't count something you don't have. You can't analyze something that you don't have the access to the facts on. He's saying there's just some things that we're not going to have an answer for, some things we just don't know, and this is coming from the one that the scriptures called the wisest man who ever lived. And his statement is here, you're not going to know. We're not going to know. And he's comfortable with leaving that question unanswered. And God sees fit to put it in the canon of scripture, in this house of the Old Testament. And that tells me that we shouldn't feel the pressure of having all the answers in full. Romans 8, what I quoted earlier, it fills the larger story. It fills in an understanding of the larger, overarching meta-narrative, and it does well for that, and it helps greatly, but it doesn't address the details. And for that, we need to be okay with sitting in reverent silence. For that, we need to recognize, okay, there are some things that I don't have a quick and easy answer for. And ultimately, we're going to find, and I'm just going to, well, we got 10 minutes. I'm going to keep going then. My iPad clock is wrong. So this says I'm 5 after, but I'm actually 10 till. So I'm good, right? So we can just keep going, right? What? The iPad can't be wrong? This is an Apple product. It can't be wrong. Okay. So he's okay with it. So actually, let's just finish up here. Verse 16. He said, I said in my heart, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. All right. In his quest, he wants to know both wisdom and madness. So, you know, we take madness in the sense in which Proverbs was representing the idea of folly, foolishness, or madness. That is an abandonment of life to self-will, to pursuing self-will. And it's not that he's saying that one is a viable alternative to the other. I'm going to try out madness and see if that works. I'm going to try out wisdom and see if that works. But it's just that he wants to understand both sides of the issue. He wants to understand from both perspectives what's at stake here, what's going on, because real wisdom is dependent on doing that, on examining things from all sides of an issue, from being willing to listen and perceive and consider things. But even after trying to look at it from the perspective of right and wrong and madness and wisdom, when we're dealing with the details, when we're confronting the complexities of life in this broken place, there is still so much that's unanswerable, that's not attainable, that's inscrutable. And where we do gain wisdom, where we do begin to find some understanding, some means of being able to apprehend what's taking place here, it's a mixed blessing, because to gain wisdom is to gain a clearer view of the sorrows that are here and the tragedies in life in a world that's so screwed up. To gain wisdom, that's what he's saying. It's full of vexation. It's full of distress and trouble the more we know. You know, you've heard that old phrase, the reason the person's smiling is because he doesn't know what's going on. That's the whole concept behind that. Now, I don't want to leave this on a pessimistic note, because this is, after all, an examination of life, remember, under the sun, from the natural light. But it's also something that is, in a very subtle way, letting us know that most of our troubling questions end up being the wrong questions to begin with. There is a subtle way in which that teacher, sitting behind that desk, smiling at us as he says all of these things, there's a subtle way in which he's trying to let us know, if you're going to predicate your life, the wellness and the wholeness of your life, on getting answers to questions, it's vanity. If you think that it's going to be all right, if you finally understand, you're chasing the wind. That's not where life is going to be found. That's not where wholeness is going to be found. In trying to acquire the answers to all of the questions that you have, there's something else. There's some other way of viewing this. There's a different plateau. And that unfolds as we go. The payoff and the resolution is at the end of the book, though we'll get hints of it as we go along. All of our attempts to provide an acceptable intellectual response concerning the real life difficulties and tragedies of this broken world are going to either end up as a futility of oversimplifications or the folly of simplistic reductionism. Neither one of them are going to satisfy. The resolution at the end of this book is ultimately going to be similar to what Jeremiah says on God's behalf. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, but let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me. And that's the real issue at stake. The real heart of this book that gets revealed at the end is this, and it's something that we have to answer for ourselves. Am I okay with unanswered questions if I know I'm okay with God? Am I okay with the idea that there are some things that I'm not going to find an answer with as long as I know I'm okay with God, and that God has something going on that I don't always understand? Life is full of unanswerable questions and difficulties that will perplex us all the way through. But Jesus has been revealed to reveal all that we need to know about God in order to get us through this strange place, in order to get us home. And we can take comfort in the fact that we know Him. We may not know all the answers, but we know Him. And knowing Him is what will make all the difference in the world. Right on? All right, very cool. Does it sound like a good study or not? All right, cool. Father, we just ask you to bless your word to our heart. Help us to understand. Open up our minds to think. stir in us a passion to explore, to contemplate and ponder, to ruminate about these deeper issues of life. Stir that up in our hearts, Lord God, so that we can, like the teacher, begin to step out and examine and look and find that resolution that he finds, that peace that comes from the knowledge that you're in control. I just pray that you do that in our lives and our hearts. Just illuminate this book to us, I pray, by your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen. Any questions?